From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Grelott, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. Today, Rebecca Cruz and I discuss record levels of smog that are forcing the closure of schools and businesses in northeast China. We'll also talk about heavy-handed tactics by Russia toward its former Soviet neighbors.
It's getting closer and closer to home. The European Union and NATO, to an extent, are also moving further and further towards Russia. And so in some ways, this feels somewhat natural that they would have this defensive policy in place.
And later, historian Kyle Harper joins me to talk about how smallpox and the bubonic plague contributed to the fall of the Roman Empire.
All of a sudden, you start having really global disease events that wipe out on a continental scale huge portions of the population.
The effects of disease and climate change on the history of civilization, coming up after this hour's news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelott. Rebecca, let's take a look at what's going on in China this week, if we can see it, that is. I mean, massive amount of smog in China, particularly the northeastern part of China. They're calling it airpocalypse. Visibility due to this heavy smog is, in some cases, only as much as 3 to 10 feet. It's reports of people not being able to see the person standing right next to them. This has closed schools. It's obviously major health alerts. Airports have been closed. Airplanes can't land. What's going on here? Why this massive amount of smog in this part of China?
Well, as you said, there's a lot of smog. And if we look at the air quality, I mean, I think that's the big concern here is there are health consequences to this amount of smog. And the air quality scores that they use in China, they're similar to the scores that we use here. The top score is 500. And the northern province that you mentioned has reached that amount at 500. That's not to say that it isn't above 500. The stops counting at 500. So this is incredibly serious. There are a couple of things that they're blaming this on. The first is a lack of wind. You know, when you have wind that can move some of that pollution or disperse it a little bit. Also, the time of the year when many of the crops, they're finished and they're now burning them to replace them in the coming year. And so there's a lot of smoke and that's in the air as well. And then, as you mentioned, winter is coming. This is a very cold part of the world. And the municipal heating structure is based on coal. And so that's adding to the pollution there.
So they've increased their coal burning power plants in order to respond to this drop in temperature that's going on right now. The very far northeast part of China. So, you know, maybe this will shift. I mean, it really doesn't seem to be due to manufacturing in the area. Like you said, just a lack of wind, a lot of burning off of last year's crops, and then cold temperatures. But certain health effects, undoubtedly.
Well, and this is something that they deal with every year, having to kind of decide, are we going to worry about pollution or worry about heat? And it just seems to be the perfect storm this year.
So on to another part of the region. Let's talk about Russia and particularly its relationship right now with its neighbors. I mean, Russia, I think, has felt for the past couple of decades, really, since the collapse of the Soviet Union and the fall of the Berlin Wall and the end of the Cold War, that many of those East European, what was once kind of the Russian buffer zone, have looked to the West. You know, we now have the Central European countries that are all members of the European Union and many others in the region that have been engaging regularly with Western Europe. And I think Russia is starting to get a little, well, not starting perhaps, but is now starting to respond with somewhat of a heavy hand with Moldova and Ukraine, Armenia, other countries in the Caucasus as they are engaging more and more with the European Union. Why are they concerned about this? What is the issue? And why deal with it with such a heavy hand? Things like stopping exports at the border and refusing to bring in Moldovan wine and, you know, making it more difficult for the Ukrainian trucks to pass into Russia. What's the point of that?
Well, as you mentioned, it's about influence. There's a loss of influence there that's been going on for over 20 years now, and they're really starting to feel it. It's getting closer and closer to home. The European Union and NATO, to an extent, are also moving further and further towards Russia. And so in some ways, this feels somewhat natural that they would have this defensive policy in place. But what's going on in the immediate future is that there's a conference going on in a month. It's actually being held in Lithuania where the EU is going to move forward and declare their intentions to increase political and economic ties with countries such as Moldova and Ukraine and others that were in the former Soviet space, that were part of the Soviet Union. This is different than when a Czech Republic or a Slovakia become part of the European Union. That was more of a satellite country. Now we're talking about the former Soviet Republic, so it's even closer to home.
Well, we'll undoubtedly return to talk about Russia in the coming months as they prepare for the Winter Olympics in Sochi. And there's a lot of controversy surrounding that particular incident and still much concern about Russian domestic politics in general. So we'll return to Russia soon.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Rebecca, for joining me today for the roundtable.
Thank you.
If you have a question or a comment for Rebecca or me, send us a tweet at WorldviewsKGOU. You can also find all of our past interviews on our website, kgou.org. Coming up, I'll talk with University of Oklahoma historian Kyle Harper. His first book examines slavery in the late Roman world, and his upcoming work focuses on how the spread of disease contributed to the fall of the Roman Empire. We'll talk about these two projects after a short break. I'm Suzette Rilat, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Rilat. We're going to step back a few millennia today with my guest, Kyle Harper. He's the director of the University of Oklahoma's Institute for the American Constitutional Heritage, and he's trained as a classical historian. He earned his PhD from Harvard in 2007 and has written books about Roman history, early Christianity, and law and economics in the ancient world. Kyle Harper, welcome to Worldviews.
Thanks for having me.
So you've got this really interesting background, trained as an ancient historian. You've written a lot about ancient Rome, issues like slavery in that part of the world at that time, sexual ethics. What is interesting about these topics to you? Why should they be interesting to us? And what is it about ancient history that matters to us today?
Well, I think the Roman Empire is a topic of perennial fascination because it's one of the great empires in the history of the world. What the Romans achieve is comparable in some ways only to some of the kind of Central Asian empires or in more recent times the British Empire. But what's so different about the Romans is that this is not a kind of steppe empire. This is not a naval empire. They build a tricontinental Iron Age empire that's grounded on land transportation, military organization in ways that no other people were able to do. And to unify the Mediterranean has been the dream of many imperialists, but only one peoples were able to achieve it. And so we perennially look back to this civilization, which flourished some 2,000 years ago, and always ask, how did they do it?
So historically speaking, the many empires have been trying to learn lessons, I think, from the Roman Empire. But the specifics of their interactions and particularly along these lines of religious history and slavery practices, ethics within that period, law, justice. I mean, are these some of the things that we can also take from the Roman Empire that transcend generations and millennia?
I think there are lessons to be learned there, and certainly we can deepen and enrich our own understanding of our place in the world and world history by having a depth of perspective that goes back through thousands of years of the human experience. And so you take a topic like slavery, which was something that I worked on for many years, and it's a subject that Americans generally know at least a little bit about because it's a part of our national history and part of the world that we have inherited. And what we need to understand is that the American experience of slavery is a very unique and particular experience, and there's an entire global history of slavery. Slavery is older than the oldest human records. Humans have been enslaving each other for probably tens of thousands of years, and there are enormous slave systems before the rise of modern Atlantic slavery, and the Roman slave system is one of those. The large-scale slave systems are rare in the pre-modern period, but the Romans create an enormous slave system, and slavery is just an integral part of Roman culture, Roman society, the entire Roman way of life. And so when you have that perspective, then you recognize some of the things that are unique about modern slavery. For instance, it's racialization. There's always a tendency to view slaves as outsiders and as inferiors, but it's only in the modern world that slavery becomes fully racialized and that racism becomes a fundamental prop of the slave system. And so when you look at Roman slavery, you're studying a slave system that ironically or paradoxically, for those of us who only are familiar, say, with modern slavery, doesn't have a kind of skin color at the root of its ideology. And so it helps us understand what slavery is and how it can be transformed in different contexts. At the same time, you can see really important similarities. Most large-scale slave systems in history have been driven by the circulation of consumer products. And so in the modern world, it's cotton, but that's really the last of the major commodities in New World slave systems. But before that, it's tobacco, it's rice, it's coffee, and above all, it's sugar. And in the Roman world, it's wine. And so when you see this huge global history of slavery, it becomes apparent in ways that you might not otherwise see how dependent the growth of really intense slave systems has been on kind of consumer products that people want, and especially addictive ones throughout history.
So how are we to feel about that then, noting that slaves have been largely responsible for producing these kinds of goods that we want and that we consume regularly?
Well, I think it makes you stop and think twice maybe about some of the kind of ways that consumer goods are produced today, hopefully. It's easy to say, well, in the past that was slavery and today we have wage labor, which is different. And it is different because the rise of free labor and the rise of abolitionism is one of the greatest changes in the history of the human experience. But at the same time, it, I hope, alerts us to keep our own eyes open for the kinds of things that people don't want to see or don't want to look at.
I'm speaking with Kyle Harper, the director of the University of Oklahoma's Institute for the American Constitutional Heritage and an historian of the classical world. Coming up, we'll talk about his next project, focusing on the effect of climate change and disease on the history of civilization. I'm Suzette Gorelott, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorelott, the dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. My guest is Kyle Harper, whose first two books focused on the social and economic history of the Roman Empire and the early Middle Ages. So your most current project that you're working on right now also focuses on the Roman Empire, but the fall of the Roman Empire, and you're looking at it from a biohistorical perspective, focusing on disease and climate change. What is it about disease and climate change that led to the fall of the Roman Empire?
Great question, and I will tell you the answer in a year or two when
as soon as you finish
this research project. But I can share with you
some of my
hypotheses that I'm testing now. The fall of the Roman Empire is one of the great questions in history, and there have been literally over 1,000 answers proffered to this question of what caused the fall of the Roman Empire. And the sheer number of answers that people have given shows you that there isn't a single answer. You're talking about an enormous civilizational change from the High Roman Empire, the classical world of the Mediterranean, to the Christian Middle Ages, to the Dark Ages of the 6th and 7th century. And it really is a collapse. It's a civilizational catastrophe in a sense, because you go from a fairly complex, prosperous, integrated society to a fragmented, in many ways poorer, certainly simpler kind of society, culturally much simpler than the kind of High Roman Empire. And so it is a real question. What causes this great imperial power to collapse and become the successor Germanic kingdoms, the barbarian kingdoms of the Dark Ages? It's a legitimate historical question. And I think every generation of historians tends to see the past to some extent through the eyes of the present. That's inevitable. But in this case, it's not even subtle. I think we live in a world where we are recognizing that human societies are sensitive to their environment and to changes in their environment. And when we look back at the Roman Empire now, we can see that changes in the Romans' environment, both the climate, but also the kind of species that live in and around humans, especially pathogens, play an enormous role in the collapse of the Roman Empire. The period of the fall of the Roman Empire, what we call late antiquity, sees the first two great pandemics in all of human history, what's called the Antonine Plague, a smallpox pandemic in the second century, and then the Justinianic Plague, which is a bubonic plague, the first real plague, in the 6th century. And these diseases had existed before, but these diseases have their own history. But there's something that happens in this period in the early first millennium when all of a sudden you start having really global disease events, pandemics that wipe out not just on a urban or city scale, but on a continental scale, huge portions of the population. And so once you start to think about it, it seems almost impossible to believe that this kind of event, the two major plagues, the two pandemics, wouldn't have had just a fundamental effect on the stability of the empire as a whole.
And how does that relate to the issue of climate change, the disease as an outcome of change in one's environment is what you're suggesting, these two things related together. And,
right.
and to bring that to current day, I mean, is there anything different then than there is now about this connection between health and our environment?
Well, diseases are sensitive to the environment, and there are many different dimensions of that. Diseases are different infectious diseases in particular are very sensitive to human population structure. And so most people in the Roman Empire die of infectious diseases. We in the modern world, after a kind of major transition in the early 20th century, we mostly die of chronic diseases. Our heart gives out, some other part of our body goes wrong. But in the ancient world, most people die of infectious diseases. And these kinds of diseases are very sensitive to variables in population structure, like population size and density. And in some ways, the arrival of these kinds of new diseases and new pandemics in the Roman Empire is an artifact of their very success. They build an enormous population, but that population is so big that it puts itself on the brink of kind of ecological disaster. And so, in a sense, the Romans are victims of their own success. They advance so far that it leaves them vulnerable to these kinds of new disease events. But at the same time, there is probably a direct climatic element in the disease history of the late empire. Different kinds of pathogens flourish even on a year-to-year basis based on the kind of weather, really. And so some kinds of diseases are particularly acute when there are warm or cold conditions or when there are wet or dry conditions. And then another kind of major variable is nutritional level. And so these ancient societies, even the Romans, which are quite successful and have quite a prosperous economic system, they're by our standards almost unimaginably poor, and huge parts of the population struggle just to get the basic calories they need on a day-to-day basis. And so they're extremely vulnerable to some kinds of pathogens which disproportionately affect people who lack stable nutrition. So what we're coming to understand about this period is changing, and one of the ways that it's changing is that we have increasing DNA evidence, and so we're starting to be able to identify the actual pathogens that killed actual individual peoples that are recovered archaeologically. And one of the things that's changing about our understanding of this period is our understanding of climate change. And this is why viewing the past through the present isn't even subtle, because we're concerned about climate change and we're trying to understand the history of the climate. Climatic fluctuation has been one of the major drivers of all global history, of history of life on Earth, and of human history in particular. And coming to understand the massive fluctuations that have affected the human species over its history is very much a part of the kind of present agenda to understand the history of the climate and the dynamics of the climate and climate fluctuation in a richer sense. And so we as historians of a period like the Roman Empire have been great beneficiaries of this, because there are a lot of smart people around the world trying to use ice cores, trying to use tree rings, trying to use speleothems, cave deposits, trying to use other kinds of proxy evidence to understand the history of climate variability. And it's giving us an almost unimaginably rich picture of climate and climate change in a period like the Roman Empire.
Well, I think that's a wonderful answer to my next question, actually, because as we were talking about the specific connection between something that happened in the ancient world, such as disease and its connection to the climate, I really wanted to kind of end with this discussion of how ancient history, or how studying you know, classical history or the classics. I mean, you're a professor of classics and letters, and so how is it that studying those things help us understand today? But it sounds very much like, you know, what we're able to do now is go back and scientifically study things that took place thousands of years ago, and that helps us understand our world today. I mean, that's one example. But, you know, if you were to make an argument as to why it is we really need to understand the Roman Empire or, you know, early or ancient history, what is the main reason? How is it that that helps us understand anything about life today?
Well, the great Roman Cicero said, to know only your own generation is to remain forever a child. And it's true. The fact that we can cite that shows the kind of wisdom of knowing the classics, that there's a certain kind of timeless knowledge that humans have achieved and preserved over thousands of years. And more importantly, the substance of what he says is that if you only know your own time and what's around you, then you have a kind of facile or even juvenile understanding of the human experience. And to think that anything is new is just not to know the past. The only new thing in the world is the history you don't know. And the Romans are very different from us. They live in a very different world. It's a pre-industrial world. It's a world of extremely high mortality and high fertility. It's a world that's very different from our own, which is an industrial and now post-industrial world, an information age, a post-fertility transition world where people live in small families and have long life expectancies. So direct comparisons are facile as well. We're not the Romans. We're very different from the Romans. But at the same time, there's something to be learned from the experience of an empire that is a world superpower that seems almost unconquerable. It seems unimaginable that it could face threats to its existence, internal or external. In fact, the Romans are quite arrogant about proclaiming themselves to be eternal. But at the same time, they knew that that all things change and that empires rise and empires fall. And so I think having a sense of the history of that and why they've risen and why they've fallen. And for the Romans, it was things that they couldn't see or couldn't understand. They have no germ theory. They have no sense of why people are dying in such huge proportions. They have no idea that the climate is changing because of small variations in the orbits of the Earth and its relationship to the sun. And so what the Romans don't know necessarily what caused their own fall, but it's exciting to think that we can have some understanding of what caused the fate of their empire, both its rise and its fall.
Well, Kyle Harper, thank you so much for joining us today to make these very important historical connections, and hopefully we'll do better about understanding our history. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to my conversation with Kyle Harper, Senior Vice Provost at the University of Oklahoma and Director of the Institute for the American Constitutional Heritage. You can read an excerpt of his book, Slavery in the Late Roman World, on our website, kgou.org. KGOU produces Worldviews through a collaborative partnership with the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Brian Hardzinski produces the show, and Hillary Gibson prepares the research for our interviews. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Gorelott.